Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke got the shoulder tap for another term. President Barack Obama praised his calm and wisdom in the face of enormous economic challenges. You got to think the news might be a mixed blessing for Bernanke. On the one hand, assuming Senate confirmation, he gets to keep his job. On the other hand, he has to keep his job. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It is the 25th day of August. Speaking in, of all places, an elementary school gymnasium, President Barack Obama made it official today. He wants Ben Bernanke to stick around for another term as Fed chairman, another term of steering the U.S. economy out of recession, another term of dodging inflation, another term of dealing with critics in Congress and elsewhere. Our New York bureau chief Amy Scott takes a look at the fight shaping up over the Fed's authority.
Fed watchers say Bernanke's confirmation should be pretty smooth going. Charles Calamiris is a professor of financial institutions at Columbia Business School.
My best guess is that there'll be some posturing, but that he'll get through.
Some of that posturing might come from Senate Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd. He's criticized the Fed chairman for his response to the financial crisis. In a statement today, Dodd said reappointing Bernanke is probably the right choice, but he said he expects many serious questions will be raised about the role of the Federal Reserve moving forward. Congress is debating how much power the Fed should have in a new regulatory regime. Bernanke has lobbied for expanding the Fed's oversight. The Milken Institute's James Barth says Bernanke's wish for the Fed to become a sort of super regulator, keeping an eye on the whole system, could take some power away from other agencies.
But obviously, the heads of the other regulatory agencies beg to differ with his particular point of view.
Yesterday, a federal judge chipped away at Fed power. She ruled that the central bank has to name the banks that borrowed money from its emergency lending programs. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Today, the government's budget forecasters predicted red ink will continue spilling all over Washington. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office and the White House Office of Management and Budget expect the federal government to add between $7 and $9 trillion to the national debt over the next decade. But how accurate can those 10-year budget projections really be? Not very, judging from the government's crystal ball gazing over the past 20 years. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
In 1999, the federal government was running a surplus, and back then, James Horney headed up the CBO's projections unit.
10 years ago, both the President's Office of Management and Budget and the Congressional Budget Office projected that in fiscal year 2009, we would have a surplus of between $400 and $500 billion.
Go back another 10 years to 1989, and forecasters were also way off, says former CBO Director Rudolph Pinner.
We were projecting big deficits for the turn of the century. The surplus caught us completely by surprise.
So where did they go so wrong? Forecasters obviously can't predict events like wars or recessions, but Alice Rivlin, President Bill Clinton's first director of the Office of Management and Budget, says budget experts at the end of the 90s couldn't foresee changes politicians would make.
The rather massive tax cuts, but also big spending increases, notably the addition of prescription drugs to Medicare.
Despite their poor track record, Rivlin says long-term projections help warn the country that government policies are unsustainable.
We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we do know that if we don't change course, either on the spending side or on the tax side, we will have very massive deficits. And that is not particularly uncertain.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So there's the explanation for these 10-year predictions, but you may have noticed earlier that I cited two budget numbers, and the gap between them was big enough to drive an entire car lot full of clunkers through. $7 trillion or $9 trillion. Joining us now is Alan Auerbach. He's professor of economics and law at UC Berkeley. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So explain for us, if you would, why the CBO and White House numbers differ by over $2 trillion.
There are two sources of the differences. One is differences in economic assumptions and economic modeling. For example, the administration is projecting higher interest rates over the next 10 years than the Congressional Budget Office is, and that means higher debt service. A second source of the difference is that the administration forecasts include proposals that the administration has made but have not yet been enacted, whereas CBO adheres to a baseline based on actual policy. For example, the president's healthcare reform, the president's cap-and-trade proposal are included in the administration projections. They are not included in the CBO forecast.
A lot of that, frankly, sounds like politics. How much and to what extent does politics figure into both of these numbers?
The budget includes a forecast of what things will look like in terms of the revenues, spending, and the deficit in future years under the assumption that their proposals are enacted. Now, sometimes the proposals are things that people don't expect to happen. For example, the administration is still including it includes its original cap and trade proposal, and if that passes at all, it's going to be a modified version. So there is some politics there, but if one looks at the economic forecasts of the administration and compares them to those of CBO or to private forecasters, there isn't any obvious place where the administration is making what one might call unrealistic economic projections to help them help their forecasts along.
And what about the rest of us who are not policymakers but hear these kinds of numbers thrown around and, you know, you hear $9 trillion, $7 trillion? What are we supposed to do with that?
If you look down the road to later years, up to 2019, both the administration and CBO are projecting higher deficits. And the most important reason for that is that revenues are coming in slower and are going to be projected to come in slower than previously. And that means that the recovery is not going to generate as much revenue as they thought. So for the longer term, the news is bad. That is, that the deficits are now being projected to be higher than they were just a few months ago. So is it good news or bad news? Well, it's sort of a mixed bag. I think on balance, it's not good news.
Well, it sounds like when it comes to deficit predictions, it's a little like the weather in New England. Just wait a minute, it'll change.
Yes, but typically for the worse. At least that's the way it's been in the last couple of years.
Alan Auerbach is a professor of economics and law at UC Berkeley. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Investors are walking, not running, for the summer finish line, ending the day up by just a few points. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Several years ago, colleges and universities across the country started offering parents an option: lock in tuition at today's prices for kids who may not even be out of diapers yet. Yes, it removed that whole matter of choice down the line, but for lots of parents, it was a very attractive option. If you wondered what was in it for the schools, some of them are now getting their answer. In Pennsylvania, the program's fund has a $223 million deficit. As Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports, the state is looking to parents to make that up.
Pennsylvania is planning to raise the price of prepaid tuition. That means instead of paying today's tuition rates, parents will pay today's tuition rates plus up to 8%.
We decided to mend it, not end it, and we've cut the problem roughly in half already.
That's Pennsylvania State Treasurer Robert McCord. He says the program lost a lot of money when the stock market tanked, but he still thinks it's sustainable in the long run.
We got caught in a pincer movement between hyperinflation in a lot of college tuitions. And then in addition to that, of course, we had the steepest downturn in 80 years.
Michael Olivas isn't surprised by Pennsylvania's woes. He's a law professor at the University of Houston who's followed college savings plans for decades. He says it's no wonder no state has started up a new prepaid college savings program in years.
Like a brilliant idea at the time, broke down in large part because they were so successful, almost like cash for clunkers. The program was so successful that even wealthy people who didn't really need these programs locked in the tuition.
And left states holding the bag. So what's a family to do? Aliva says stick with the old-fashioned college savings plan, basically a 401k for college. He says it's at least as good as saving tuition money in your mattress. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
While parents mull over all the new reasons for going deep into debt for college, the Obama administration is setting aside $100 billion for education programs. About $5 billion of that will go to states that improve students' education the most. How will they figure out which states are the most successful? Well, with tests, of course. Testing is at the heart of Mike Rose's new book, Why School? He's a professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education, and he offers a different approach to the way America teaches and learns.
I think that over the last couple decades, the emphasis in education policy has shifted somewhat. We've moved very much in the direction toward school as the engine for economic mobility, for job preparation. And we measure our success in doing that by a system of standardized tests and high accountability. Now, look, the economic motive has always been very important in the United States. And as somebody from a working-class background for whom schooling made a huge difference, I'm all for that. But there's been other motives as well. The Jeffersonian motive of wanting to develop citizens, the motive of intellectual growth.
So your title that asks the very provocative question, why school? You're not questioning school itself. You're questioning school in its current form.
Right. And its current emphasis, I guess. What concerns me is the kind of thing we saw with No Child Left Behind and that I fear might be carried over into this administration, and that is this notion that the purpose of school is to prepare young people for a quote-unquote 21st century economy. Again, that's hugely important. I don't want to deny it. But if that becomes what you hear all the time in public policy, we've got research that shows that it compresses the curriculum. You're going to hit math and reading hard, and those are important, but literature, the humanities, arts, science, history, knowing history, that tends to be downplayed.
You know, what about the question, if we don't change the system, what kind of citizens are we raising?
The image of the citizen in a democracy that I have, and I think that certainly Jefferson had, is of people who are able to use history to make current decisions, people who can solve problems even when the solution isn't clear.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a curriculum that is narrowed with a kind of test that doesn't tap into all of those qualities and doesn't develop them, then the system isn't going to lead to the development of that kind of person. Now, here's an irony test that has struck me. The business community, time after time, in position paper and opinion piece, tells us that it needs people who can make frontline kinds of decisions, who communicate well, who are creative, who think outside the box. And again, if you have a curriculum that doesn't generate and encourage that kind of thinking and learning, then you're not going to produce those kind of folks.
Mike Rose is the author of a new book called Why School? Mike, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure, Tess.
Today we're continuing our series Econ Fun 01 about what economists do with their free time. You know, how they have fun or try to, if only their big money brains would turn off. Commentator Justin Wolfers takes exercise to a competitive level. What's economics got to do with that? Well, for Justin, just about everything.
I'm not just an economist. I'm also a runner, training for the Marine Corps Marathon. Runner's World magazine recently argued that marathon running is an incredibly cheap sport. All you need is a pair of shoes, and you're off and running. But they're wrong. You see, they were emphasizing the out-of-pocket cost, which is small. But the foundation of all economics is something called opportunity cost. It says that the true cost of something is the alternative that you have to give up. So each hour that I spend running is an hour that I don't spend hanging out, working, or sleeping. How do I choose? Following economic theory, I keep doing an activity only as long as it yields greater benefits than the alternative. And as I spend my hours slugging out the miles, I'm forced to confront my choices. Instead of sweating it out on the trails, I could take on extra teaching and earn a few extra bucks. And so going running costs me good money. The same logic applies to you. Each hour you spend on your hobby is an hour that you don't spend working harder to get a promotion, studying for a degree, or shopping around for the cheapest groceries. By my calculations, my 16-week training program comes at an opportunity cost of several thousand dollars. A quicker runner would have a smaller opportunity cost. It's only because I'm both slow and an economist that I fret that the world's cheapest sport is actually incredibly expensive. But to an economist, the choice is still a no-brainer. We think that you should only do what you love and pay for it by doing what you're good at. By sticking to economics, I make time for running. Rather than spend hundreds of dollars worth of time cleaning my house each Sunday, I hire a cleaner who does a better job at a better price. When a friend asks me to help them move, I write them a check to pay professional movers instead. It's just more efficient. And while it can be hard to forgo extra income for a long run, it's even harder to justify wasting that time on Facebook. And with the time that saves, I'm pulling on my shoes to head out for another run.
Justin Wolfers teaches business and public policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Your thoughts? Write to us at marketplace.org. Coming up, the race is on to save seeds.
Globally, we are losing crop varieties as fast as we ever have.
But first, let's do the numbers. Some positive consumer sentiment and word of Ben Bernanke's return engagement nudged buying along. The Dow picked up 30 points, a third of a percent, to end at 95.39. The Nasdaq gained 6 points, also about a third of a percent, to finish at 20.24. The S&P scored 2 points, 0.25%, to wind up at 10.28. Some consumer stocks rose along with consumer sentiment. Macy's Star rose 3.5%. Presentable results from Chico's added 7.5% to the women's retailer. Bed Bath & Beyond cozied up 4.25%. And closeout retailer Big Lots finalized a 6.5% rise. The 10-year T-note gained a tad more, pushing the yield down to 3.43%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of July. It's spot on. Pet lovers and animal activists mark National Dog Day. And I love warning you when people are going to start a food fight. The annual tomato throwing festival, La Tomatina, takes place in Buñol, Spain. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
You had a lot to say about our interviews over the past few weeks. Two in particular drew some notice. The first was one that Kai did with our car expert Dan Neal about the 2010 Buick LaCrosse. Dan pointed out that Buick customers tend to be older. He said the cars should come with dialysis machines. Gudrun Eastham Pope of Camarillo, California, says there could have been a more tactful aside.
My 68-year-old husband takes dialysis, and he and I both would have been better served and entertained if Dan Neal had said in his interview, the car would come with a dial phone, cassette tape machine, and paper maps.
The second interview was one I did with John Wasik about his book, The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome. Wasik talked about Americans' obsession with owning land and building homes. Professor Margaret Garb teaches American history at Washington University in St. Louis. She says the interview missed the backstory of the housing craze.
Everybody seems to think that home ownership is just part of the American inheritance, that somehow people are born with a home ownership gene or something like that, when in fact it's really the result of very specific historical changes that occurred in the United States in the late 19th century and then dramatic shifts in American politics and public life that occurred during the New Deal.
Some big shifts are happening in a couple of European countries. Over the past week, we reported the German and French economies had grown last quarter. Richard Johnston hears us in Manhattan and says that growth is possible because of social safety nets.
People in Europe don't live in fear in the same way that Americans do, because in America, to lose your job is catastrophic because you lose almost all of your income and you're in line to lose your health care.
And one last note from the Marketplace Desk of Public Service. We recently aired a story about how Hertz is using new technology to monitor dings and damage to their rental car fleet. Chuck Flax of San Diego, California, says the story made him look more closely at his bill from Hertz after returning a rental car.
The next morning, got a bill from Hertz, and on the bill were fuel and maintenance charges. And the fuel and maintenance charges were actually larger than the cost of renting the car, because we'd only rented the car one day. And I called Hertz, and they said, I'm sorry, there was a key punch error.
He says Marketplace saved him $28. Not bad.
Oh, absolutely. No, I was thrilled.
So if we're saving you money or costing you peace of mind, do tell us. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says Contact. Curators from international seed banks are meeting outside Washington today. These so-called banks store the seeds of thousands of crop varieties from around the world, most of which will never see a supermarket shelf. But as a warming climate threatens mainstream agriculture, these unique genes in the little-known seeds could turn out to be crucial for feeding the planet. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
I'm in a tiny southern Arizona town called Patagonia. And it's hot, about 107 degrees today. The hills around me are parched and brown, but the field I'm standing in pulses with life. Suzanne Nelson is conservation director for Native Seed Search. It's a nonprofit that saves and distributes seeds from ancient Southwest crops like maize, beans, and sunflowers. Many of the plants now thriving on this 60-acre seed farm are the same ones Southwest Indians cultivated here long before Columbus.
This is a brown tepary bean. It's got a pretty large tap root, and the leaves will actually fold up on each other, so they're shading each other and preventing water loss through the leaf surfaces.
Qualities that enabled these early crops to survive in the hot Southwest deserts. But today, they may hold even more value. Nelson says plant breeders are racing to craft new seeds that can withstand the heat waves and diseases of a warmer planet. And some of the genes in these ancient heirloom crops may hold the answer. Peter Breding is with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Plant Gene Bank program.
We have found genes for resistance to diseases or insects in genetic materials where we would not have suspected it to be until we tested them.
Breding says the world's enormous diversity of heirloom crops is like a vast library of unopened books. Unfortunately, scientists like Breding may never have a chance to study many of them. That's because farmers across the world are swapping out regional varieties for only a handful of high-yielding crops sold by international seed companies. Gary Nabhan is author of Where Our Food Comes From.
Globally, we are losing crop varieties as fast as we ever have.
Take apples. Back in the pioneer days, the U.S. had more than 7,000 named varieties. Today, that number has fallen to around 300. The USDA's Peter Breding says once those seeds are gone,
you lose another tool out of your toolbox. You lose another option.
Freezing seeds in special vaults is a way to ensure that doesn't happen. Even Native Seeds maintains one at its Tucson headquarters. These so-called seed banks serve as an important source of genetic material for scientists and even for international seed companies. But Gary Nabhan says Native Seeds' primary mission, saving seeds in fields rather than vaults, is the one that matters the most.
Plant breeders cannot breed new varieties adapted to hotter conditions rapidly enough to keep up with the pace of climate change. And so the more varieties we have adapted and being adapted in fields, as opposed to being frozen in time in a seed bank, the better off we are.
On the Gila River Indian Reservation south of Phoenix, Native Seeds' vision is being realized.
This is all beans. They're called a stalta buff. They're beans that you can see that they're flowered and they're just about ready to put on their little pod.
75-year-old Janet Haskey grows traditional Indian varieties of bean, melon, and maize. Native Seeds supplies the seeds free of charge. Haskey says there's a big difference between these seeds and the ones she's ordered from mainstream catalogs.
They survive.
She has childhood memories of her father growing these same crops, the seeds passed down and continually adapting from generation to generation, until the convenience of modern lifestyles and eating habits intervened. Now, many decades later, Haskey is resurrecting that age-old tradition.
We need to start taking care of our seeds and really handling them like they're gold. They're precious.
In southern Arizona, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Sam took some pictures of the seed farm. They're on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, the Red Cross says it's feeling a new side effect from the recession. All the job losses mean fewer people available to donate at corporate blood drives. It says up to 80% of donated blood comes from companies hosting those drives. Coming to the Red Cross's rescue, Hollywood. Next month, the CW Network debuts the latest blood-sucking storyline to come to television, The Vampire Diaries. The advertising campaign includes a plea to starve a vampire by donating blood. Who knows, it could defang the recession's impact on the Red Cross. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 30 points, a third of a percent. The Nasdaq added 6 points, also 0.3%. And the S&P added 2 points, a quarter of 1%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Next time on the program, marketers look to the local. I mean really local.
Never mind the United States, not even East Coast, West Coast. I think brands are going to have to think city by city.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.